Can I start?
Yeah.
Okay. Proverbs 22 says, a good name has great wealth. And the wealth that we acquired from our father was not financial, but it was the people and the places that we were able to go because of him.
Very good. Did you want to get into the Abner story?
Yeah, I can.
Okay. Why don't we start there and just tell me the story that Abner told you that struck you as so poignant.
I stay in touch with a lot of the old players, and I recently spoke to Abner Haynes, and we were talking about old times. We were talking about family. We were talking about the lessons learned that, you know, from my dad. And he went on to tell me this story that I thought that was really kind of the foundation of what became the success of Hank Stram as a coach, as a father, and as a parent. And Abner basically started the story by saying that it was 1961. Training camp had broken. It was a day that the players, the rosters were to get down to the 36 members, the final 36 members. And Dad had called the meeting at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So everybody got there and Dad was running about 5 minutes late, which was uncommon for him. He was always very punctual. And everybody was sitting there nervously and very anxious. And Abner's thoughts were going through Abner's mind. You know, will I be here next year? Who will be here? What's he want to tell us? Shortly thereafter, 5 minutes later, he comes into the room and he said, I want you guys to look around, look at the face of the guy standing next to you. I want you to all know that you in this room are the 1961 members of the Dallas Texan family. You not only are part of this football team, but you represent the great city of Dallas. You represent the Hunt organization, and you're part of my family, the Stram family. Abner said, after he said those words, he felt that he belonged. He believed the words, the messages that he was saying. And he said that I knew then that we would win, and we did. And I thought that was something that I thought was pretty much carried over to my dad's entire career. And I think that was one of the great reasons for his success, because he talked about family, and all those guys were family. Once he said, you guys, we're not going to be a team for a real, real long time, but we'll always be a family.
So, you know, that team was one of, you know, the first teams to really have a solid contingent of black players. And they were black players, even on teams where there were plenty, they still weren't really feeling welcome in a lot of places. So for your dad to say something like that, you know, to Abner and to the rest of his teammates, what did that do for Abner's trust in your
dad? I think it went on a little further than that, the story. He said that everybody turned around, they were all excited, they hugged each other, and the whites didn't care if he was black. They all hugged together. They were part of a team. I look back at my dad, and I'm just amazed by the things that, you know, from the background that he came. You know, he lost his father when he was 13. He's, you know, Polish. He lived in a Polish, environment, family environment. You know, for him to come into Dallas, Texas, and, you know, coach, to be faced with prejudice and the way he handled things, and Dad had been threatened. He had been threatened for having blacks on the football team in 1960 in Dallas. And Dad, instead of, you know, shying away from it, what he did is he got aggressive and he said, you know what, I'm going to highlight Abner Haynes. People are going to realize not only what a great player is. Once they realize what a great player he is, they'll want to know more about him, and they'll respect him and accept him as a man. And, you know, really back in those days, blacks and whites weren't together except for in the music industry or the in Hollywood. So, you know, there's a lot of players on that team that originally that 1960 team, there was four blacks on the team, and there was guys on the team that were white that had never played with a black man.
Would you say that Abner, having the role that he did and the offense being so tailored around him, was that the biggest role that a black player had on a pro football team to that point?
Well, beyond that, Dad elected him as the captain of the team in 1962, the first black player that was ever a captain in the American Football League. So Dad had there was no color lines. You know, it was about a team and it was about family. And to this day, you know, or up until the time he passed away, we were always a family, and we're still a family. I feel like I'm still connected with these guys as my extended family.
And talk about that a little bit more. When your dad said that, you know, those players were a part of the Stram family, and when you say that you look at those guys as your older brothers, neither one of you are kidding. How were they your older brothers? What sort of relationship did you have with these guys?
I didn't know there was any difference. I never knew black or white, and I didn't know anybody ever had any problems with, you know, one race or the other. So it was very innocent. It was very, you know, Abner, I remember going up to Abner and he'd hug me and he'd hold me. And there's a great picture of Abner and my brother Stu on the sideline, and Abner's like hugging him and Stu's, you know, smiling. And I mean, it was just, we never knew that there was anything, any difference. But I did hear stories, you know, and then as I got older and I heard stories about in 1961 when the Texans played the Chargers in Little Rock, Arkansas, and they flew into Little Rock and Abner got off the bus with Cheryl Hedrick and Chris Burford and got in the first bus, and then the rest of the guys got off and got in the other bus. Well, the bus driver in the first bus would not leave. And they sat there and sat there and sat there. And Dad goes, "What the hell is the problem?" And it finally came to his attention that the bus driver was not going to drive the bus until Abner got off the first bus and got to the back of the second bus. So beyond that, they finally did. They got to, they took the bus. The black players were, I think, maybe four or five of them in 61 were on the second bus. The first bus pulls into this nice hotel and they start getting out. The second bus just kept going over the railroad tracks and dropped and made the black players get out and stay at a housing, you know, some kind of motel on the other side of town. Wow. And it was really something that was devastating to Dad, and he apologized and he guaranteed that it would never happen again. As long as he was the coach of that team, that this would never happen again. But I think that, you know, that showed that there was this realization that the world wasn't like, you know, like as idealistic as what Dad thought it was. I guess Dad always thought, he always looked at the best of people, and I guess he had to have been tremendously disappointed by people that acted that way, badly like that.
Sure. Well, I was wondering if you could just kind of give me an idea of what it was like to really grow up with the AFL, with the football team every day, with the, you know, with these players. What was that like for you? You had a unique perspective.
It was really amazing. From the time I was 4 and a half, you know, Mom would say, "Who wants to go with Dad?" And I'd always have my hand up. I was always going with Dad. So we'd go. I remember when they were building the facility on Central Expressway. It was a metal corrugated building, and it had the metal studs up. And I remember driving by there before they enclosed it all, and they were building the practice field. And I remember. You know, they had this agricultural watering system that was these big pipes that they would have to, like, eight or nine guys would have to pick it up and move it just to water the field. And so, I mean, I remember from all the way back, and I would go to the office with my dad and just eventually wander back to where the players were. And, you know, I learned some lessons back there. I remember E.J. Holub, you know, one day he was, you know, a chewer, you know, chewing tobacco, and being 4 or 5 years old. And I thought, you know, anything that was in a pouch had to be candy. I said, is that candy? And he says, no, but would you like to try a little bit of it? And I got my first taste of chewing tobacco, probably about 5 years old. I remember burning my mouth and spitting it out. And one of the other great stories, I think it is, it was during a practice one day, and I was playing catch with one of the ball boys, and we were throwing the ball back and forth, and I dropped the pass, and I said, shit. Okay. I said, oh, shit. And Mr. Hunt was standing right next to me, and he goes, Dale, what did you just say? I said, oh, shit. He said, well, do you know what it means? And I said, no, I don't know what it means, but I know that's what you're supposed to say when you drop a pass. So, you know, I learned some of those things at a very early age as well.
That's funny.
Yeah. So.
What player would you say that you were closest to growing up? What was your relationship like?
There were certain hero guys on the team that I was, you know, that I really kind of bonded with. And EJ was one because he was like a big kid, you know, the chewing tobacco thing. And once or twice he would tape me up with tape and, you know, to one of the lockers or something. And, you know, I remember we went to a practice at the bus terminal in Dallas, and it had rained and rained and rained for like a week, and we couldn't really practice. And so we went to the bus terminal inside, and it was this big open span, you know, area. And so they had practice and stuff. And so we took a bus from Central Expressway over to the bus terminal. And on the way back, EJ taped me to one of the poles. And all the guys were off the bus. And there was one guy left, and it was Ted Green. And Ted Green became my hero, and he was my favorite guy after that, after he cut me loose. So
what was your dad's attitude towards it? Was he just kind of...
Oh, I mean, it was all playful. You know, Dad always used to say, you know, football players are little boys with big bodies. And, you know, they are. You know, there's guys that are 22 to 27 years old, and you think of what you did when you were that age. So it was all in fun, and it was all in love, and it was never... I affectionately recall those instances and with EJ. And actually, later on in life, and, you know, EJ was born, he wore number 55, and that was actually the year I was born. And when I turned 13 years old in 1969, I received my confirmation, and I asked EJ to be my sponsor. And I remember they had a game that week and couldn't do it, but he wrote a beautiful, beautiful, you know, letter to me, which I still recall still means a lot to me to this day.
What type of person was EJ? What drew you to him?
He was say that again?
What type of person was EJ? What drew you to him?
I guess he was just a kid, you know, he was just a big kid. He was a holler guy. He was very, you know, he was a very emotional, very, you know, another great story about EJ was that from the time we moved to Kansas City, EJ was always a horseman, and he always would transport his horse from West Texas to Kansas City during the football season. So right before training camp was going to come, right before it was going to start, EJ would be coming into town. He would drive to our house at like 5 in the morning, honking the horn, honking, yelling, screaming, waking everybody up in the neighborhood, knocking, pounding on the door, and mom would wake up, and, you know, and she would make a stack of pancakes. That's when we knew the season was starting. And he did the same thing at the end of the season. He'd be going back to Texas. He'd leave the stables. He'd bring his horse, trailer the horse, bring it to our house, pounding on the door. It was always some ungodly time in the morning, waking up everybody in the house. But it was that was EJ, and he was a beautiful guy, just a beautiful guy.
So, do you have a recollection of what those early years were like? With the Texans in Dallas?
You know, it was, I think really the nucleus of the team were together early on. And you know, we went through so much hardship, you know, the question of will the league survive? And then will we be able to stay in Dallas? And you know, the different players, and going on beyond Dallas, you know, in 1963, you probably know the story of Stone Johnson, and the players that lived that were, you probably recall that a lot of the players were all drafted regionally, and Lamar thought that was a good way to do it, is to get a high profile player from the area closest to the team city, so you would already have a fan base that would be able to would start watching and following them. So a lot of the guys from the Dallas Texans were all from the Texas Dallas area. So when we ended up moving, it was devastating. I remember Jerry Mays had talked about retiring. Dad wasn't going to move. He wanted the team to move to Miami. A lot of the guys, it was a really traumatic thing. So we moved to Kansas City, and on August 30th, 1963, in a preseason game in Wichita, Kansas, which happened to be the first game that I attended as a child with the team in Wichita, Kansas. Stone Johnson was blocking on a kickoff return late in the second half, and somehow it was a freak accident. He slipped and some guy's thigh hit him in the head, and he broke his neck, and he broke it right in front of my brother Henry and I. And back then they didn't have ambulances on the field, and he laid there for 45 minutes on the field. And that kind of started the whole trend of ambulances being at the stadiums. But, you know, after that, it was kind of like, you know, and these guys were getting paid $50 a preseason game. And so it took a lot out of those guys. That was a hardship. And then in 64, Ed Buddy gets in a bar fight and gets his head caved in. In 65, Freddie Arbanez gets hit in the eye and loses his eye. In 65, Mackley Hill dies on the table. These guys, every time something traumatic happened, they got closer and closer. And, you know, it's not like what it was like today, where these guys all have Game Boys and they got music and they got all the stuff, that they just retreat from having to converse with anybody. They sit in their lockers and they, you know, these guys were all together all the time. And they just got bonding, and they bonded together, which made them the great team. And they had the nucleus and the overcoming adversity that made them the champion that they ultimately became.
I read a story that, you know, supposedly the last car to leave Dallas to go to Kansas City was you with Lamar Hunt Jr., your brother, and Lamar in his Oldsmobile. Can you tell that story, or do you remember that?
Yeah, I do. I do remember it, and I remember I think we were on the Central Expressway, and Mr. Hunt had no money. And I remember he wrote a check for like 10 cents or whatever the heck it was. They get across, and we drove, and I remember staying at a hotel, and, you know, it wasn't a really long drive. We spent the night, and then we drove to Liberty the next day. But I'll never forget, because I was so excited. I had been apart from my dad for, you know, three or four weeks, and I was so excited to see him. And I remember going up upstairs in his office and seeing him, and then peeking through the window. He saw me, he came running out and gave me a hug, and it was just one of the greatest hugs. And also I remember Bobby Yarbrough, who was the equipment manager, as we drove into the gym area where the training facility and everything was, he had gotten burned like a washing machine had scalded him, and he was all he was like he had thick bacon grease all over his body to help whatever it was to help with the burns. But
what were the circumstances of that drive up to Kansas City? How did that? How did you end up in that car? Like, what? Tell that whole story.
Well, mom and the smaller kids were gonna my mom, my brother Henry, and the two younger kids were gonna go three younger ones were moving from Dallas, and they were gonna move with the moving van and follow in the car. So I got an opportunity to go early, and mom said, would you like to go? And I said, sure would. So I ended up going, and Mr. Hunt was driving, and the rest of it was history. But
so what was your impression of Kansas City? I guess more importantly, how did your dad kind of react to that whole transition?
I mean, from Kansas City to...
No, from Dallas to Kansas City.
Well, I think after the Stone Johnson incident, I think people thought, man, this was not the right thing to do, is move here. You know, we were promised to sell, I think Roe Bartle had promised 14,000 tickets to be sold, season tickets to be sold. And, the first game had five. And, I remember hearing a story of Lenny Dawson telling the story about, a preseason game that everybody wrapped around, all the players stood around the perimeter of the old municipal stadium with autographed balls. And on three, they were supposed to throw the balls up into the stands. And Lenny turned to the guy next to him and said, "What the hell are we throwing the ball for? We should just hand it to him. There's nobody." There was like 100 balls and 100 people in the stands. So I think it was a real hard transition initially for that. And then, coupled with the problem that happened with Ed Buddy, and then happened with Freddie Arbanis and so on, it was tough. It was a tough transition.
How invested, to back it up a little bit, how invested was your dad in the battle for Dallas between the Cowboys and the Texans? I mean, was that in the back of the players and the coaches' minds of, not only are we trying to beat the Chargers and
right,
we're trying to win over Dallas. This is our city.
Right. The dad's, I have some letters that I'll show you later that showed the main thing, the content of the letter was anything short of being a champion is going to be not acceptable. And so, I think that he stayed focused. And the only thing, Dad used to always say, you can't control things. I mean, you can't worry about things you can't control. And he couldn't control it. All he could do was win. And he felt that, if they won, that they would win. Everybody wants to be with a winner. The Cowboys were 0-13 or whatever they were the first year. But, they drew pretty close to what we drew because, you had the benefit of seeing Jim Brown come into town and play, and Lou Groza and some of these other great players at the time, Raymond Berry, play at the time. So we had a bunch of cast-off guys, but we played a better brand of football. Mm-hmm. So
what was how did your dad and the guys on the team kind of perceive or react to the perception that the AFL was this second-rate league? How did they kind of see that, I guess?
Well, I think from day one and as things progressed, I think the whole motivation was to prove otherwise, that we weren't, that we were something special, that we were on the same plane as the National Football League, if not better. We had better personnel. We just didn't have we didn't have the age associated with it. We were just a new team, but we were playing good ball. And I think ultimately that's what was shown at the end of the AFL-NFL rivalry, Super Bowl rivalries, we split, 2-2.
What, after that, the first Super Bowl, how did your dad kind of react to that game? Because I think there was the sting of the loss, but there was also the, everybody was probably thinking, yeah, I figured figured as much. The AFL is not anything. How did he kind of handle that with his team?
I think Dad really felt that they matched up. That he thought that the Chiefs were better offensively than the Packers were, and we weren't as good defensively. And I think that he was extremely disappointed. And I remember Lloyd Wells telling me one day, he goes, you know, most unbelievable thing your dad said to me when we were coming off the field at that Super Bowl. He said, you know what? We're going to come back. We're going to win a Super Bowl. We're going to win the Super Bowl. And he looked at him like he was, you know, and Dad was focused on that. He bettered the team by getting better defensive players. And, you know, ultimately, you know, won in 69, and we had a hell of a run at it in 71.
Did your dad kind of, I mean, winning Super Bowl IV was kind of the ultimate legitimization of Lamar's big gamble of starting the AFL. It was kind of that point where you're like, okay, the AFL is really as high quality of a product as the NFL. We just saw it on the field. Did your dad kind of see that all? Did he understand the role he was playing in kind of helping Lamar achieve that goal?
No, because I think they just both had the same goal. Dad just wanted to win. No matter what he did, he wanted to win. If it was golf, if it was paddleball, if it was racquetball, if it was football, he wanted to win. So he was so focused on that, there was really nothing else anyway, besides winning. So I don't think that he got wrapped up in all that. I think one thing that comes to mind that was kind of interesting that I recall was during the Super Bowl I, we went, my brother Henry and I went to Los Angeles to that game for the 2 weeks prior to the Super Bowl game, and stayed Long Beach. And Lombardi came in, his team came and went to Santa Barbara and locked everybody out, wouldn't take an interview with anybody, with none of the networks, wouldn't appear on anything. He just locked himself and locked the team down. Dad felt that was a great opportunity because there was all these reporters around to be able to allow them to put a face to this new league. So he told Jim Schaaf, he said, Shakey, if anybody comes and they want to interview with me, I'm going to try my darndest to do it. I don't care if it's at midnight. So Dad did that. He went on the Hollywood Palace. He ended up doing all the different interviews. And I think, you know, it did ultimately, you know, change the opinion that maybe the media might have had of the American Football League just because of that.
What, you know, you kind of mentioned Lombardi there. That dynamic between Vince Lombardi and Coach Stram is really kind of an interesting one. Do you kind of see they're kind of like the antithesis of each other? You got this stern and very uptight classic model of a head coach in the NFL, and then you've got your dad who was so effusive and had this personality. Did you kind of appreciate that that dynamic there at all?
Well, were you able to hear the mm-hmm. tapes that I sent you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, in different ways, in a more colorful way, Dad said the same thing about family, about team, about the importance of, you know, of those things, character, the same things that Lombardi talked about. And I think, you know, there's a common denominator with all great coaches that, you know, it doesn't change. The time has gone by. And, you know, the great coaches of the 60s and the great teams of the 60s, they basically had a lot of the same characteristics. And I really see, you know, I see similarities, and both of them were brilliant in their own way.
After, I guess, you know, you spoke about the comments your dad made immediately after Super Bowl I. What effect did that loss end up having in the following seasons on the way that he coached and on the way that he drafted and that sort of thing?
Well, I think that obviously he felt that they were capable, they were close to being, you know, another Super Bowl team offensively, but they ended up needing some help. So, you know, they ended up, you know, and we ended up getting Willie Lanier, and we got Jim Lynch, you know, and I think Emmett Thomas came in, and, you know, these are Hall of Famers. You know, those are unbelievable. You know, we ended up getting Curly Culp and, you know, for like nothing from the Houston Oilers, another Hall of Famer. We had Buck. We had one of the biggest defenses, you know, in football, you know, and one of the greatest defenses in football. I mean, I remember hearing a story before Super Bowl IV that Lenny says to Johnny Robinson, or Johnny says to Lenny, he says, "What is coach? How do you guys look? How do you guys match up against these team, this Minnesota team?" He said, "We have a great game plan. I think we're going to do really well." And he said, and Lenny asked Johnny, "Well, what about you? What do you guys? How do you think?" He said, "I'm gonna be shocked if they score." I mean, that's how damn good that defense was. That was a hell of a defense that developed there, and, you know, over those next couple years. So
that's cool. You mentioned Lenny. What was, I mean, your dad and Lenny go all the way back. What was their relationship like?
Well, Lenny was playing in a game against Wisconsin the day I was born in 1955, playing Wisconsin. Purdue was playing Wisconsin. My dad was an assistant coach. And, you know, Lenny and Jackie had gotten married before college. And they lived off campus. And because they lived off campus, they didn't have the food and some of the other things. My mom's father ran Piggly Wiggly, a grocery store in Lafayette. And he would get food and stuff and to give to my dad, and my dad would take it over to Lenny. That was back in, you know, dad recruited him in when he was 18 years old. And I heard the great story about dad. They had put together a passing reel for Purdue, and dad was trying to entice Lenny to come to Purdue because they were going to start throwing the ball. Nobody else was throwing the ball. So they have this passing reel. And after watching the passing reel, Lenny goes, "Coach, did any of those quarterbacks ever throw an incompleted forward pass?" Because it was a highlight reel, you know, you're not going to have your drops or anything. But I thought that was kind of a cute story that dad used to tell about Lenny. But dad was very close with Lenny, and you know, he loved Lenny and cared very much about Lenny, and I think the feelings were mutual. He was a great leader, and he was just a great player, just a great player.
What kind of boost was that? I guess that was 1962 when your dad brought Lenny in. What did that do for that team?
Well, you know, dad didn't talk to, you know, Lamar actually orchestrated that trade and with behind my dad's back. So my dad was extremely hurt that he did that, and he didn't talk to Lamar for a couple weeks. But the big problem that we had when he did that was that they traded Cotton Davidson to the Raiders. Well, Cotton Davidson was also the punter. So basically what it did, he lost two positions. Not only what would have been a good backup quarterback, but he lost his punter. So really it affected their play and their strategy of play for the remainder of the season. In situations, they ended up having to go for some things and do some things offensively to change things around because they had no punter. They had, I think, Wilson. I'll think of his name, number 12. Eddie Wilson was the backup, and he was not very good. So on the flip side, you know, that was something that dad, you know, Lamar promised that he would never do that again, and he never did. But on the flip side, you know, we got the number one pick, and you know who we got? We got Buck Buchanan. So, you know, it was who was one of the greats that ever played the game.
Yeah. in the end it worked out. But you know what, when Lenny first came in, there was talk of your dad was kind of shocked at like how kind of sloppy his fundamentals were. What did you talk about?
Well,
that?
Dad, yeah, he hadn't seen him, and you know, in his mind's eye, he was always, you know, that great quarterback at Purdue, and thought that he would just step right back in there. But I mean, he had gotten rusty, you know, his skills had needed polish. And when he first got in there, Dad talked to, hey, man, I might have made a mistake bringing him in here. But as time went on, you know, Dad was one of the great quarterback coaches that ever lived. I mean, he really was. I mean, he did things with the quarterbacks. I think he understood the position better than anybody. You know, the importance of footwork and follow through and throwing the ball with, you know, off your fingertips and doing all these little drills. I remember these tremendous great drills that he used to have for the quarterbacks. So, I mean, I think he saw and knew what Lenny needed to work on to help refine his skills to getting back to what he once was. And they did. And he did. And he was, you know, rest of it's, he's in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, it definitely ended up working out. So, let's see. Do you need a sip of water? Are you good? So, in what ways would you say your dad was an innovator?
Well, you know, the obvious things are, you know, the triple stack defense and you know, the moving pocket and you know, the cockeye formations and, you know, running double tight ends. And when people said you couldn't play zone defense in that league and at that caliber, he puts the zone in against George Blanda in 1962 and beats him 30-7. You know, all these things that he was never afraid to do what he felt was best. And he didn't care what anybody said or what anybody did, but he was an innovator in that those senses. But you know, back in those days, Dad always used to say, you know, if you can't win your division, you can't win the Super Bowl. So they used to draft. It was like a chess match. You know, they would draft. We get Otis Taylor, and hey, the Raiders were our top rival. They get Willie Brown. You know, we got Buck Buchanan. The Raiders go out and get Gene Upshaw, you know. So, just seeing, I guess I'm off the path of innovation, but like I had mentioned to you about the Star Spangled Banner, he was one of the first ones that I ever know that lined up numerically all the players in single file with their right hand on their heart and their helmet on the left, and you know, they rehearsed that before games. You know, he did those type of things.
How much of a thinker was he about the games? I mean, you sent me that kind of essay that he wrote about the state of offenses in the game. How much time did he spend thinking about scheming?
I think Dad used to love, in the off season, he had a pool, and Dad used to lay out in the pool until there was like a oil slick this wide around the outside of the pool. I mean, he would lay there and he would come up. That's where he came up with the moving pocket and all these different things. And I think he was always thinking about what he could do to better his chances to win. And he was just a brilliant little guy. I mean, he was amazing.
Talk about his competitiveness a little bit. You know, he was kind of a very specific type of competitor, and I mean, you tell that story about him playing golf with you, and just to what lengths would your dad go to win a game?
A game of,
well, anything.
Well, I think you know, it's funny. I ran into John Madden at the Super Bowl. I mean, at the Hall of Fame a couple years ago. He goes, yeah. that damn, you had that priest over there on the sideline over there, you know? He said, you know, I had my wife write a note to the Pope and said, hey, what's this priest doing over there? Shouldn't he be doing something else besides going to a football game? Well, Dan was always trying to get whatever edge it was, if it was from above or whatever the heck it was. He was always trying to get an edge. So when you're talking about competing, if you're talking about competing in golf or a racquetball or what any of those things, he would go pretty far to win, but he had a charm about him that you never felt like, you know, you kind of just knew this is kind of the game the guy's going to play. And, you know, you kind of just went along with it. And at the end, you kind of had a laugh over it after he moves the ball from behind the tree and has a perfect shot at the green. You know, you just kind of came to expect it and everybody knew it. So I don't think it was anything that was with ill will that he did, but it was, you know, he would do whatever it took to win. He was competitive.
In watching footage of your dad on the sidelines and kind of seeing him interact with his players, even in the Super Bowl, you know, you just kind of get a sense of how kind of at ease he is. He's sitting there laughing on the sidelines, enjoying himself. Then you look over across the sidelines and you've got across the field and say Vince Lombardi or any other coach has the prototypical stern facial expression, but your dad just seemed to be having a good time. Was that part of his personality, do you think?
Dad got into a zone. You know, he got into a zone, and I remember going up to him and saying things to him during the game that he just never even realize he was his own. He turned into a whole different, you know, he had a tremendous personality. He had a great colorful personality, and I think that shows when he was on the sideline. I think he did everything with that same type of flair, you know, that's shown in all those sideline shots of during the Super Bowl. So
how much you know, when you talk about, when you say he just had a great personality, what can you tell us about, like, you know, the nicknames he had for the guys and all the different word choices he had? What was that like?
You never knew what the, you know, he could have used one word that can have 10 meanings. I mean, you know, if it was kind of a juicy type of a, you know, like smush. You know, you don't know what the hell a smush is. You know, it's smush when he's playing racquetball. It's a kill shot in the corner. You know, if he sees Ed Sable, it's smush. You know, it's their smush. You know, and you know so you never knew what the heck, you know, a lot of those words were. But he definitely had a real flair with nicknames, and you know, I think that the Chiefs had some great nicknames. A lot of those players had great nicknames. You know, you had EJ the Beast, and you had Huzza, which was Jerry Mays, and you had Elmer Fudd. They called Mike Garrett Elmer Fudd, and you had Bluto, which is Ed Buddy, and you know, OT was Otis, and Lenny the Cool, and you know, everybody kind of had a nickname, and it was all an affectionate. It was a way of affection, I think, that they used them, you know.
Why do you think your dad was such a great dresser and was so conscientious of his style?
Well, I think it all started from the fact that his dad was a tailor and he was a suit salesman, so he always had to look good, and I think he started Dad on that path of dress. But I think ultimately the reason that he became so, you know, much in it, because he got a lot of free clothes. You know, I mean, he was dear friends with the Hager family, and every time there was a slacks or a shirt or a coat or whatever it was, they would send him one. And he was, you know, getting stuff from people all over the place. Even though he did design some of his own clothes, You know, he had a guy that was in Kansas City Custom Garment, was what it was called. I remember many a times Dad would say, come on, kids, you want to go take a ride? Sure. We pull up into this place downtown Kansas City, and we'll sit in a fire zone while Dad's looking at fabrics and stuff, and they're measuring them for a suit. We're in there for about 3 hours in the car, and then double parked there while he's getting a suit made. But he loved clothes. He loved clothes.
Well, you know, I'm assuming you've seen the NFL Films piece of your dad being mic'd for the Super Bowl. How cool is that for you to be able to watch?
Well, I was on the sidelines. I was right there. I mean, I heard him call 65 toss power trap. I saw him pat Gloucester on the rear to run in there, and I saw the excitement. And I was standing right, you know, next to on the sidelines when Otis, near where Otis caught that pass, that hitch pass, and ran into the end zone. So I mean, seeing it all is like reliving it all for me, as well as it was just, you know, seeing my dad with, you know, the great thing about clips are, you know, I get the benefit to see my dad again. And I always see him in a state of when he was the best, and he was the happiest. So it's a real great thing to have people like yourself, you know, documenting his life and keeping his life, his legacy alive.
Why do you think he agreed to be mic'd?
I think probably because he didn't. I don't think that he saw any kind of bigger scheme. I don't think he saw any bigger picture. I think it was a friend asking him, and, you know, why not get mic'd? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think that there was a whole lot of, and really, I think that once the game started, I mean, he never knew he was mic'd. I mean, it was, he had forgotten it until the guy came back and took the mic off, mm-hmm. You know, and he ultimately had final say on whether or not the thing was going to be able to do anything with it. So until he saw it, who knew that they were going to release it until he saw it? And I think he was kind of embarrassed in a way when he first saw it, and he didn't want to have him release it. And Sable said, hey, no, you got to release this. This is great. There's nobody else that could do something like this and at this time, and you need to release it. And I think he did. I think that's, you know, he twisted his arm a little bit.
Looking back at that, Mikey, do you have a favorite moment?
Well, you know, I think one of the great moments, you know, obviously was when the countdown, and, you know, they carry him off the field, and, you know, to be that close to people that reach their goal in life, it's pretty powerful. You know, especially when you see it with people you love.
You know, you know, looking back on that, how important was that miking for your father? I mean, being able to kind of announce his personality to the world, in a sense. How cool was that for kind of everybody to be able to get to know your father in a way?
You know, you find that people follow a winner, and when you win, they follow you. And when you don't win, they don't follow you. And I think, you know, he was at the top, and it added. Really, I mean, back at that time when he did that film, I mean, there was not the NFL Network, and I think it was shown at certain premieres, and you had to rent the film from NFL Films to show it at whatever events it was. So it wasn't as widely circulated that so many people saw it. I mean, you know, they saw it, and people in Kansas City saw it because it was in Kansas City. But I think now it's, you know, it's an institution. You know, the fact that it's been shown, and it's one of the most sought after, requested films that NFL Films ever did. So, but at the time, I don't know if it was really as big as it is, it's become.
When, kind of take us into the moment, as we're all watching it and seeing what it's like to be on an NFL sideline in 1969, what were you kind of thinking in those moments, like when he called 65 toss by our track? What was that moment like for you?
You know, it means a whole lot more to me now, looking back. But, you know, when you're 13 years old and you're just part of your life and you've seen it so often and you don't come to appreciate it until some point, you know, it's kind of almost like religion. You know, I went to a Catholic school and we learned all these things and we learned all the religion. And it was a certain time in my life, maybe when I was in my 40s or something, that it really hit me and sunk in. So I think in a way that's the way it is now. It's just reflecting back on it. It's just so special because I've been removed from it for so long.
When he says, take a break.
You want another water or something?
I'm good. I'm fine.
Huh?